25. That's how many are missing from the roster. Our maximum strength was 250. Not that we actually have that many in camp at any given time, but still. The battle literally decimated us. I felt as if Alar had passed through me. Decimation. The ancient punishment for bad legions was a grim business. Every 10th soldier was killed, whether they were guilty or innocent. I'm so sorry, Frank. I should have... I didn't know how to finish that sentence. I should have what? I was no longer a god. I could no longer snap my fingers and cause zombies to explode from 1,000 miles away. I had never adequately appreciated such simple pleasures. Frank pulled his cloak tighter around his shoulders. It was hardest on the civilians. A lot of retired legionnaires from New Rome came out to help. They've always acted as our reserves. Anyway, that line of prophecy you mentioned, bodies fill the Tiber beyond count. That didn't mean there were many bodies after the battle. It meant we couldn't count our dead, because they disappeared. My gut wound began to seethe. Disappeared how? Some were dragged away when the undead retreated. We tried to get them all, but... He turned up his palms. A few got swallowed by the ground. Even Hazel couldn't explain it. Most went underwater during the fight in the Little Tiber. The Naiads tried to search and recover for us. No luck. He didn't vocalize the truly horrible thing about this news, but I imagined he was thinking it. Their dead had not simply disappeared. They would be back, as enemies. Frank kept his gaze on the cobblestones. I try not to dwell on it. I'm supposed to lead, stay confident, you know? But like today, when we saw Terminus, there's usually a little girl, Julia, who helps him out. She's about 7. Adorable kid. She wasn't there today. No, Frank agreed. She's with the foster family. Her father and mother both died in the fight. It was too much. I put my hand against the nearest wall. Another innocent little girl made to suffer like Meg McCaffrey when Nero killed her father. Like Georgina when she was taken from her mother's in Indianapolis. These 3 monstrous Roman emperors had shattered so many lives. I had to put a stop to it. Frank took my arm gently. 1 foot in front of the other. That's the only way to do it. I had come here to support the Romans. Instead, this Roman was supporting me. We made our way past cafes and storefronts. I tried to focus on anything positive. The grapevines were budding. The fountain still had running water. The buildings in this neighborhood were all intact. At least the city didn't burn, I ventured. Frank frowned like he didn't see the cause for optimism. What do you mean? That other line of prophecy. The words that memory wrought are set to fire. That refers to Ella and Tyson's work on the Sibylline books, doesn't it? The books must be safe, since you prevented the city from burning.
Oh.
Frank made a sound somewhere between a cough and a laugh.
Yeah. Funny thing about that.
He stopped in front of a quaint-looking bookstore. Painted on the green awning was the simple word, Libri. Racks of used hardcovers were set out on the sidewalk for browsing. Inside the window, a large orange cat sunned itself atop a stack of dictionaries.
Prophecy lines don't always mean what you think they do.
Frank rapped on the door. 3 sharp taps, 2 slow ones, then 2 fast ones. Immediately, the door flew inward. Standing in the entrance was a bare-chested, grinning Cyclops.
"Come in," said Tyson. "I am getting a tattoo."
Chapter 8. Tattoos. Get yours now. Free wherever books are sold. Also, a large cat. My advice? Never enter a place where a Cyclops gets his tattoos. The odor is memorable, like a boiling vat of ink and leather purses. Cyclops skin is much tougher than human skin, requiring superheated needles to inject the ink, hence the odious burning smell. How did I know this? I had a long, bad history with Cyclopes. Millennia ago, I'd killed 4 of my father's favorites, because they had made the lightning bolt that killed my son, Asclepius. And because I couldn't kill the actual murderer, who was, Zeus. That's how I got banished to Earth as a mortal the first time. The stench of burning Cyclops brought back the memory of that wonderful rampage. Then there were the countless other times I'd run into Cyclopes over the years, fighting alongside them during the first Titan War, always with a clothespin over my nose, trying to teach them how to craft a proper bow when they had no depth perception, surprising one on the toilet in the labyrinth during my travels with Meg and Grover. I will never get that image out of my head. Mind you, I had no problem with Tyson himself. Percy Jackson had declared him a brother. After the last war against Kronos, Zeus had rewarded Tyson with the title of general and a very nice stick. As far as Cyclopes went, Tyson was tolerable. He took up no more space than a large human. He'd never forged a lightning bolt that had killed anyone I liked. His gentle, big brown eye and his broad smile made him look almost as cuddly as Frank. Best of all, he had devoted himself to helping Ella the Harpy reconstruct the lost Sibylline books. Reconstructing lost prophecy books is always a good way to win a prophecy god's heart. Nevertheless, when Tyson turned to lead us into the bookstore, I had to suppress a yelp of horror. It looked like he was having the complete works of Charles Dickens engraved on his back. From his neck to halfway down his back scrolled line after line of miniature bruised purple script, interrupted only by streaks of old white scar tissue. Next to me, Frank whispered, "Don't." I realized I was on the verge of tears. I was having sympathy pains from the idea of so much tattooing, and from whatever abuse the poor Cyclops had suffered to get such scars. I wanted to sob, "You poor thing," or even give the bare-chested Cyclops a hug, which would have been a first for me. Frank was warning me not to make a big deal out of Tyson's back. I wiped my eyes and tried to compose myself. In the middle of the store, Tyson stopped and faced us. He grinned, spreading his arms with pride.
"See? Books!"
He was not lying. From the cashier station / information desk at the center of the room, freestanding shelves radiated in all directions, crammed with tomes of every size and shape. 2 ladders led to a railed balcony, also wall-to-wall books. Overstuffed reading chairs filled every available corner. Huge windows offered views of the city aqueduct and the hills beyond. The sunlight streamed in like warm honey, making the shop feel comfortable and drowsy. It would have been the perfect place to plop down and leaf through a relaxing novel. Except for that pesky smell of boiling oil and leather. There was no visible tattoo parlor equipment, but against the back wall, under a sign that read Special Collections, a set of thick velvet curtains seemed to provide access to a back room.
"Very nice," I said, trying not to make it sound like a question.
"Books,"
Tyson repeated,
Because it's a bookstore.
Of course, I nodded agreeably. Is this, your store?
Tyson pouted.
No. Sort of. The owner died. In the battle. It was sad.
Ah. I wasn't sure what to say to that. At any rate, it's good to see you again, Tyson. You probably don't recognize me in this form, but...
You are Apollo.
He laughed.
You look funny now.
Frank covered his mouth and coughed, no doubt to hide a smile.
Tyson, is Ella around? I wanted Apollo to hear what you guys discovered.
Ella is in the back room. She was giving me a tattoo.
He leaned toward me and lowered his voice.
Ella is pretty, but shh, she doesn't like me saying that all the time. She gets embarrassed. Then I get embarrassed.
I won't tell, I promised. Lead on, General Tyson.
General.
Tyson laughed some more.
Yes, that's me. I bashed some heads in the war.
He galloped away like he was riding a hobby horse, straight through the velvet curtains. Part of me wanted to turn, leave, and take Frank for another cup of coffee. I dreaded what we might find on the other side of those curtains. Then something at my feet said, "Meow." The cat had found me. The enormous orange tabby, which must have eaten all the other bookstore cats to achieve its current size, pushed its head against my leg. "It's touching me," I complained.
"That's Aristophanes," Frank smiled.
"He's harmless. Besides, you know how Romans feel about cats."
"Yes, yes, don't remind me." I had never been a fan of felines. They were self-centered, smug, and thought they owned the world. In other words, all right, I'll say it, I didn't like the competition. For Romans, however, cats were a symbol of freedom and independence. They were allowed to wander anywhere they wished, even inside temples. Several times over the centuries, I'd found my altar smelling like a tomcat's new marking post.
"Meow,"
Aristophanes said again. His sleepy eyes, pale green as lime pulp, seemed to say, "You're mine now, and I may pee on you later." "I have to go," I told the cat. "Frank Zheng, let's find our harpy." As I suspected, the special collections room had been set up as a tattoo parlor. Rolling bookshelves had been pushed aside, heaped with leather-bound volumes, wooden scroll cases, and clay cuneiform tablets. Dominating the center of the room, a black leather reclining chair with foldable arms gleamed under an LED magnifying lamp. At its side stood a workstation with four humming electric steel needle guns, connected to ink hoses. I myself had never gotten a tattoo. When I was a god, if I wanted some ink on my skin, I could simply will it into being. But this setup reminded me of something Hephaestus might try. A lunatic experiment in godly dentistry, perhaps. In the back corner, a ladder led to a second-level balcony, similar to the one in the main room. Two sleeping areas had been created up there. One, a harpy's nest of straw, cloth, and shredded paper. The other, a sort of cardboard fort made of old appliance boxes. I decided not to inquire. Pacing behind the tattoo chair was Ella herself, mumbling as if having an internal argument. Aristophanes, who had followed us inside, began shadowing the harpy, trying to butt his head against Ella's leathery bird legs. Every so often, one of her rust-colored feathers fluttered away, and Aristophanes pounced on it. Ella ignored the cat completely. They seemed like a match made in Elysium.
"Fire," Ella muttered. "Fire with
Something, something, something bridge, twice something, something.
She seemed agitated, though I gathered that was her natural state. From what little I knew, Percy, Hazel, and Frank had discovered Ella living in Portland, Oregon's main library, subsisting on food scraps and nesting in discarded novels. Somehow, at some point, the Harpy had chanced across copies of the Sibylline books, three volumes that had been thought lost forever in a fire toward the end of the Roman Empire. Discovering a copy would have been like finding an unknown Bessie Smith recording, or a pristine Batman number one from 1940. Except more, prophecy-ish. With her photographic but disjointed memory, Ella was now the sole source of those old prophecies. Percy, Hazel, and Frank had brought her to Camp Jupiter, where she could live in safety and hopefully recreate the lost books with the help of Tyson, her doting boyfriend. Cyclops friend? Interspecies significant other? Past that, Ella was an enigma, wrapped in red feathers, wrapped in a linen shift.
No, no, no.
She ran one hand through her luxurious swirls of red hair, ruffling it so vigorously I was afraid she might give her scalp lacerations.
Not enough words, 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 Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2.
She looked in good health for a former street harpy. Her human-like face was angular but not emaciated. Her arm feathers were carefully preened. Her weight seemed about right for an avian, so she must have been getting plenty of birdseed or tacos or whatever harpies preferred to eat. Her taloned feet had shredded a well-defined path where she paced across the carpet.
Ella, look, Tyson announced. Friends!
Ella frowned, her eyes sliding off Frank and me as if we were minor annoyances. Pictures hung askew on a wall.
No,
she decided. Her long fingernails clacked together.
Tyson needs more tattoos.
Okay.
Tyson grinned as if this were fantastic news. He bounded over to the reclining chair.
Wait,
I pleaded. It was bad enough to smell the tattoos. If I saw them being made, I was sure I would puke all over Aristophanes.
Ella, before you start, could you please explain what's going on?
What's going on?
Ella said. Marvin Gaye, 1971.
Yes, I know, I said. I helped write that song.
No.
Ella shook her head.
Written by Ronaldo Benson, Al Cleveland, and Marvin Gaye, inspired by an incident of police brutality.
Frank smirked at me. You can't argue with the harpy.
No.
Ella agreed.
You can't.
She scuttled over and studied me more carefully, sniffing at my bandaged belly, poking my chest. Her feathers glistened like rust in the rain.
Apollo,
she said.
You're all wrong, though.
Wrong body, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, directed by Don Siegel, 1956. I did not like being compared to a black and white horror film, but I'd just been told not to argue with the harpy. Meanwhile, Tyson adjusted the tattoo chair into a flat bed. He lay on his stomach, the recently inked purple lines of script rippling across his scarred, muscular back.
Ready,
he announced. The obvious finally dawned on me. The words that memory wrought are set to fire, I recalled.
You're rewriting the Sibylline books on Tyson with hot needles. That's what the prophecy meant.
Yep.
Ella poked my love handles, as if assessing them for a writing surface.
Nope, too flabby.
Thanks, I grumbled. Frank shifted his weight, suddenly looking self-conscious about his own writing surfaces.
Ella says it's the only way she can record the words in the right order, he explained. On living skin.
I shouldn't have been surprised. In the last few months, I'd sorted out prophecies by listening to the insane voices of trees, hallucinating in a dark cave, and racing across a fiery crossword puzzle. By comparison, assembling a manuscript on a cyclops' back sounded downright civilized. But how far have you gotten? I asked. The first lumbar, Ella said.
She showed no sign that she was joking.
Face down on his torture bed, Tyson paddled his feet excitedly.
Ready? Oh boy, tattoos tickle.
Ella, I tried again. What I mean is, have you found anything useful for us concerning, oh, I don't know, threats in the next 4 days? Frank said you had a lead.
Yep, found the tomb.
She poked my love handles again.
Death, 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 lots of death.
Chapter 9. Dearly beloved, we are gathered here because Hera stinks. Amen. If there is anything worse than hearing death, 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 it's hearing those words while having your flab poked.
Can you be more specific?
I actually wanted to ask, can you make all of this go away and can you also stop poking me? But I doubted I would get either wish.
Cross-references,
Ella said.
Sorry? Tarquin's tomb, she said. The Burning Maze words, Frank told me. Apollo faces death in Tarquin's tomb unless the doorway to the soundless god is opened by Bellona's daughter.
I know the prophecy, I said. I sort of wish people would stop repeating it. What exactly?
Cross-referenced Tarquin and Bellona and Soundless God with Tyson's index.
I turned to Frank, who seemed to be the only other comprehensible person in the room. Tyson has an index? Frank shrugged.
He wouldn't be much of a reference book without an index. On the back of my thigh!
Tyson called, still happily kicking his feet, waiting to be engraved with red-hot needles.
Want to see?
No, gods, no. So you cross-referenced?
Yep, yep, said Ella. No results for Bellona or the Soundless God.
She tapped the sides of her head.
Need more words for those, but Tarquin's tomb.
Yep, found a line. She scuttled to the tattoo chair, Aristophanes trotting close behind, swatting at her wings. Ella tapped Tyson's shoulder blade.
Here.
Tyson giggled.
A wildcat near the spinning lights,
Ella read aloud.
The tomb of Tarquin with horses bright, to open his door, 254.
Meow,
said Aristophanes.
No, Aristophanes, Ella said, her tone softening. You are not a wildcat.
The beast purred like a chainsaw. I waited for more prophecy. Most of the Sibylline books read like the joy of cooking, with sacrificial recipes to placate the gods in the event of certain catastrophes. Plague of locusts ruining your crops. Try the Ciri souffle with loaves of honey bread roasted over her altar for 3 days.
Earthquake destroying the city.
When Neptune comes home tonight, surprise him with 3 black bulls basted in holy oil and burned in a fire pit with sprigs of rosemary. But Ella seemed to be done reading. Frank, I said, did that make any sense to you?
He frowned.
I thought you would understand it.
When would people realize that just because I was the god of prophecy didn't mean I understood prophecies? I was also the god of poetry, Did I understand the metaphors in T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland?
No.
Ella, I said, could those lines describe a location?
Yep, yep. Close by, probably. But only to go in, look around, find out the right things and leave. Not to kill Tarquinius Superbus, nope. He's much too dead to kill. For that, need more words.
Frank Zhang picked at the mural crown badge on his chest.
Tarquinius Superbus, the last king of Rome. He was considered a myth even back in Imperial Roman times. His tomb was never discovered. Why would he be?
He gestured around us.
In our neck of the woods,
I finished. Probably the same reason Mount Olympus is hovering above New York, or Camp Jupiter is in the Bay Area.
Okay, that's fair, Frank admitted. Still, if the tomb of a Roman king was near Camp Jupiter, why would we just be learning about it now? Why the attack of the undead?
I didn't have a ready answer. I'd been so fixated on Caligula and Commodus, I hadn't given much thought to Tarquinius Superbus. As evil as he might have been, Tarquin had been a minor league player compared to the emperors. Nor did I understand why a semi-legendary, barbaric, apparently undead Roman king would have joined forces with the triumvirate. Some distant memory tickled at the base of my skull. It couldn't be a coincidence that Tarquin would make himself known, just as Ella and Tyson were reconstructing the Sibylline books. I remembered my dream of the purple-eyed entity, the deep voice that had possessed the Euronymous in the tunnel.
You of all people should understand the fragile boundary between life and death.
The cut across my stomach throbbed. Just once, for variety, I wished I could encounter a tomb where the occupants were actually dead. So, Ella, I said, you suggest we find this tomb?
Yep. Go in the tomb. Tomb Raider for PC, PlayStation, and Sega Saturn, 1996. Tombs of Atuan, Ursula Le Guin, Athenaeum Press, 1971.
I barely noticed the extraneous information this time. If I stayed here much longer, I'd probably start speaking in Ellaese too, spouting random Wikipedia references after every sentence. I really needed to leave before that happened. But we only go in to look around, I said, to find out
the right things. Yep, yep.
And then?
Come back alive. Staying Alive, The Bee Gees, second single, Saturday Night Fever, motion picture soundtrack, 1977.
Right. And you're sure there's no more information in the Cyclops Index that might actually be, oh, helpful? Ella stared at Frank, then trotted over and sniffed his face.
Firewood.
Something.
No. That's for later.
Frank couldn't have looked more like a cornered animal if he'd actually turned into one.
Ella? We don't talk about the firewood.
That reminded me of another reason I liked Frank Zhang. He too was a member of the I Hate Hera Club. In Frank's case, Hera had inexplicably tied his life force to a small piece of wood, which I'd heard Frank now carried around with him at all times. If the wood burned up, so did Frank. Such a typical controlling Hera thing to do. I love you, and you're my special hero. And also, here's a stick. When it burns, you die. Ha 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 ha. I disliked that woman. Ella ruffled her feathers, providing Aristophanes with lots of new targets to play with.
Fire with something, something bridge. Twice something, something, Nope, that's later. Need more words. Tyson needs a tattoo.
Yay, said Tyson. Can you also do a picture of Rainbow? He's my friend. He's a fish pony.
A rainbow is white light, Ella said,
refracted through water droplets.
Also a fish pony, Tyson said.
Hmm, said Ella. I got the feeling I had just witnessed the closest the Harpy and Cyclops ever came to having an argument. You two can go. Ella brushed us away. Come back tomorrow, maybe 3 days. 8 days a week, Beatles' first UK release, 1964. Not sure yet.
I was about to protest that we had only 4 days before Caligula's yachts arrived and Camp Jupiter suffered another onslaught of destruction, but Frank stopped me with a touch on the arm.
We should go. Let her work. It's almost time for evening muster anyway.
After the mention of firewood, I got the feeling he would have used any fawn-level excuse to get out of that bookstore.
My last glimpse of the special collections room was Ella holding her tattoo gun, etching steaming words on Tyson's back while the Cyclops giggled.
It tickles!
And Aristophanes used the Harpy's rough leather legs as scratching posts. Some images, like Cyclops tattoos, are permanent once burned onto your brain. Frank hustled us back to camp as fast as my wounded gut would tolerate. I wanted to ask him about Ella's comments, but Frank wasn't in a talkative mood. Every so often, his hand strayed to the side of his belt, where a cloth pouch hung tucked behind his scabbard. I hadn't noticed it before, but I assumed this was where he stored his Hura-cursed life-ending souvenir. Trademark. Or perhaps Frank was somber because he knew what awaited us at evening muster. The Legion had assembled for the funeral procession. At the head of the column stood Hannibal, the Legion's elephant, decked in Kevlar and black flowers. Harnessed behind him was a wagon with Jason's coffin, draped in purple and gold. 4 of the cohorts had fallen into line behind the coffin, with purple Larrys shifting in and out of their ranks. The 5th cohort, Jason's original unit, served as honor guards and torchbearers on either side of the wagon. Standing with them, between Hazel and Lavinia, was Meg McCaffrey. She frowned when she saw me and mouthed, "You're late." Frank jogged over to join Raina, who was waiting at Hannibal's shoulder. The senior praetor looked drained and weary, as if she'd spent the last few hours weeping in private and then pulled herself back together as best she could. Next to her stood the Legion standard bearer, holding aloft the eagle of the 12th. Being close to the eagle made my hair stand on end. The golden icon reeked of Jupiter's power. The air around it crackled with energy. Apollo. Raina's tone was formal, her eyes like empty wells. Are you prepared? For... The question died in my throat. Everyone was staring at me expectantly. Did they want another song? No. Of course. The Legion had no high priest, no Pontifex Maximus. Their former augur, my descendant Octavian, had died in the battle against Gaia, which I had a hard time feeling sad about, but that's another story. Jason would have been the logical next choice to officiate, but he was our guest of honor. That meant that I, as a former god, was the ranking spiritual authority. I would be expected to lead the funeral rites. Romans were all about proper etiquette. I couldn't excuse myself without that being taken as a bad omen. Besides, I owed Jason my best, even if that was a sad Lester Papadopoulos version of my best. I tried to remember the correct Roman invocation. Dearly beloved? No. Why is this night different? No. Aha. Come, my friends, I said. Let us escort our brother to his final feast. I suppose I did all right. No one looked scandalized,
I turned and led the way out of the fort, the entire legion following in eerie silence. Along the road to Temple Hill, I had a few moments of panic. What if I led the procession in the wrong direction? What if we ended up in the parking lot of an Oakland Safeway? The golden eagle of the 12th loomed over my shoulder, charging the air with ozone. I imagined Jupiter speaking through its crackle and hum, like a voice over shortwave radio.
Your fault. Your punishment.
Back in January, when I'd fallen to Earth, those words had seemed horribly unfair. Now, as I led Jason Grace to his final resting place, I believed them. So much of what had happened was my fault. So much of it could never be made right. Jason had exacted a promise from me. When you're a god again, remember. Remember what it's like to be human. I meant to keep that promise. If I survived long enough. But in the meantime, there were more pressing ways I needed to honor Jason. By protecting Camp Jupiter, defeating the Triumvirate, and, according to Ella, descending into the tomb of an undead king. Ella's words rattled around in my head. A wildcat near the spinning lights. The tomb of Tarquin with horses bright. To open his door, 254. Even for a prophecy, the lines seemed like gibberish. The Sibyl of Cumae had always been vague and verbose. She refused to take editorial direction. She'd written 9 entire volumes of Sibylline books. Honestly, who needs 9 books to finish a series? I'd secretly felt vindicated when she'd been unable to sell them to the Romans until she whittled them down to a trilogy. The other 6 volumes had gone straight into the fire when I froze. Behind me, the procession creaked and shuffled to a halt. Apollo? Reyna whispered. I shouldn't stop. I was officiating Jason's funeral. I couldn't fall down, roll into a ball, and cry. That would be a definite no-no. But Jupiter's gym shorts, why did my brain insist on remembering important facts at such inconvenient times? Of course Tarquin was connected to the Sibylline books. Of course he would choose now to show himself and send an army of undead against Camp Jupiter. And the Sibyl of Cumae herself? Was it possible? Apollo, Reyna said again, more insistently. I'm fine. I lied. One problem at a time. Jason Grace deserved my full attention. I forced down my turbulent thoughts and kept walking. When I reached Temple Hill, it was obvious where to go. At the base of Jupiter's temple stood an elaborate wooden pyre. At each corner, an honor guard waited with a blazing torch. Jason's coffin would burn in the shadow of our father's temple. That seemed bitterly appropriate. The legion's cohorts fanned out in a semicircle around the pyre, the Lares in their ranks glowing like birthday candles. The 5th cohort unloaded Jason's coffin and bore it to the platform. Hannibal and his funeral cart were led away. Behind the legion, at the periphery of the torchlight, Oro wind spirits swirled about, setting up folding tables and black tablecloths. Others flew in with drink pitchers, stacks of plates, and baskets of food. No Roman funeral would be complete without a final meal for the departed. Only after the food was shared by the mourners would the Romans consider Jason's spirit safely on its way to the underworld. Immune from indignities like becoming a restless ghost or a zombie. While the legionnaires got settled, Reyna and Frank joined me at the pyre. You had me worried, Reyna said. Is your wound still bothering you? It's getting better, I said. Though I might have been trying to assure myself more than her. Also, why did she have to look so beautiful in the firelight?
We'll have the healers look at it again, Frank promised. Why did you stop in the road?
Just remembered something. Tell you later. I don't suppose you guys had any luck notifying Jason's family. Thalia?
They exchanged frustrated looks.
We tried, of course, Raina said. Thalia's the only earthly family he had, but with the communications problems.
I nodded, unsurprised.
One of the more annoying things the Triumvirate had done was to shut down all forms of magical communication used by demigods. Iris messages failed. Letters sent by wind spirits never arrived. Even mortal technology, which demigods tried to avoid anyway because it attracted monsters, now wouldn't work for them at all.
How the Emperors had managed this, I had no idea.
I wish we could wait for Thalia, I said, watching as the last of the fifth cohort pallbearers climbed down from the pyre.
Me too, Raina agreed.
But
I know, I said.
Roman funeral rites were meant to be performed as soon as possible. Cremation was necessary to send Jason's spirit along. It would allow the community to grieve and heal, or at least turn our attention to the next threat.
Let's begin, I said.
Raina and Frank rejoined the front line. I began to speak, the Latin ritual verses pouring out of me. I chanted from instinct, barely aware of the words' meanings. I had already praised Jason with my song. That had been deeply personal. This was just a necessary formality. In some corner of my mind, I wondered if this was how mortals felt when they used to pray to me. Perhaps their devotions had been nothing but muscle memory, reciting by rote while their minds drifted elsewhere, uninterested in my glory. I found the idea strangely understandable. Now that I was immortal, why should I not practice nonviolent resistance against the gods, too? I finished my benediction. I gestured for the Ore to distribute the feast, to place the first serving on Jason's coffin, so he could symbolically share a last meal with his brethren in the mortal world. Once that happened and the pyre was lit, Jason's soul would cross the Styx. So Roman tradition said. Before the torches could be set to the wood, a plaintive howl echoed in the distance. Then another, much closer. An uneasy ripple passed through the assembled demigods. Their expressions weren't alarmed, exactly, but definitely surprised, as if they hadn't planned on extra guests. Hannibal grunted and stamped. At the edges of our gathering, gray wolves emerged from the gloom. Dozens of huge beasts keening for the death of Jason, a member of their pack. Directly behind the pyre, on the raised steps of Jupiter's temple, the largest wolf appeared, her silvery hide glowing in the torchlight. I felt the legion holding its collective breath. No one knelt. When facing Lupa, the wolf goddess, guardian spirit of Rome, you don't kneel or show any sign of weakness. Instead, we stood respectfully, holding our ground as the pack bayed around us. At last, Lupa fixed me with her lamp yellow eyes. With a curl of her lip, she gave me a simple order. Come. Then she turned and paced into the darkness of the temple. Raina approached me. Looks like the wolf goddess wants to have a private word. She frowned with concern. We'll get the feast started. You go ahead. Hopefully Lupa isn't angry. Or hungry.
Chapter 10. Sing it with me. Who's afraid of the big good wolf?
Me. That would be me.
Lupo was both angry and hungry.
I didn't claim to be fluent in wolf, but I'd spent enough time around my sister's pack to understand the basics.
Feelings were the easiest to read.
Lupa, like all her kind, spoke in a combination of glances, snarls, ear twitches, postures, and pheromones.
It was quite an elegant language, though not well suited to rhyming couplets. Believe me, I'd tried.
Nothing rhymes with
grr-rrr-rrr.
Lupa was trembling with fury over Jason's death. The ketones on her breath indicated she had not eaten in days. The anger made her hungry. The hunger made her angry. And her twitching nostrils told her that I was the nearest, most convenient sack of mortal meat. Nevertheless, I followed her into Jupiter's massive temple. I had little choice. Ringing the open-air pavilion, columns the size of redwoods supported a domed, gilded ceiling. The floor was a colorful mosaic of Latin inscriptions. Prophecies, memorials, dire warnings to praise Jupiter or face his lightning. In the center, behind a marble altar, rose a massive golden statue of Dad himself, Jupiter Optimus Maximus, draped in a purple silk toga big enough to be a ship's sail. He looked stern, wise, and paternal, though he was only one of those in real life. Seeing him tower above me, lightning bolt raised, I had to fight the urge to cower and plead. I knew it was only a statue, but if you've ever been traumatized by someone, you'll understand. It doesn't take much to trigger those old fears. A look, a sound, a familiar situation, or a 50-foot-tall golden statue of your abuser. That does the trick. Lupa stood before the altar. Mist shrouded her fur as if she were off-gassing quicksilver.
It is your time, she told me.
Or something like that. Her gestures conveyed expectation and urgency. She wanted me to do something. Her scent told me she wasn't sure I was capable of it. I swallowed dryly, which in itself was wolf for I'm scared. No doubt Lupa already smelled my fear. It wasn't possible to lie in Lupa's language. Threaten, bully, cajole, yes, but not outright lie.
My time, I said. For what exactly?
She nipped the air in annoyance.
To be Apollo. The pack needs you.
I wanted to scream, I've been trying to be Apollo. It's not that easy. But I restrained my body language from broadcasting that message. Talking face to face with any god is dangerous business. I was out of practice. True, I'd seen Britta Martis back in Indianapolis, but she didn't count. She liked torturing me too much to want to kill me. With Lupa, though, I had to be careful. Even when I'd been a god myself, I'd never been able to get a good read on the wolf mother. She didn't hang out with the Olympians. She never came to the family Saturnalia dinners. Not once had she attended our monthly book group, even when we discussed dances with wolves.
Fine, I relented. I know what you mean.
The last lines from the dark prophecy. I've reached the Tiber alive, etc., etc. Now I am supposed to jive? I assume that entails more than dancing and snapping my fingers. Lupa's stomach growled. The more I talked, the tastier I smelled.
The pack is weak.
She signaled with a glance toward the funeral pyre.
Too many have died. When the enemy surrounds this place, you must show strength. You must summon help.
I tried to suppress another wolfish display of irritation,
Upo was a goddess. This was her city, her camp. She had a pack of supernatural wolves at her command. Why couldn't she help? But of course, I knew the answer. Wolves are not frontline fighters. They are hunters who attack only when they have overwhelming numbers. Lupa expected her Romans to solve their own problems, to be self-sufficient or die. She would advise. She would teach and guide and warn, but she would not fight their battles. Our battles. Which made me wonder why she was telling me to summon help, and what help. My expression and body language must have conveyed the question. She flicked her ears. North. Scout the tomb. Find answers. That is the first step. Outside, at the base of the temple, the funeral pyre crackled and roared. Smoke drifted through the open rotunda, buffeting the statue of Jupiter. I hoped somewhere up on Mount Olympus, Dad's divine sinuses were suffering. Tarquinius Superbus, I said. He's the one who sent the undead. He'll attack again at the blood moon. Lupa's nostrils twitched in confirmation. His stench is on you. Be careful in his tomb. The emperors were foolish to call him forth. Emperor was a difficult concept to express in wolf. The term for it could mean alpha wolf, pack leader, or submit to me now before I rip out your jugular. I was fairly sure I interpreted Lupa's meaning correctly. Her pheromones read danger, disgust, apprehension, outrage, more danger. I put a hand over my bandaged abdomen. I was getting better. Wasn't I? I'd been slathered with enough Lemurian spice and unicorn horn shavings to kill a zombie mastodon. But I didn't like Lupa's worried look. Or the idea of anyone's stench being on me. Especially not an undead king's. Once I explore this tomb, I said, and get out alive, what then? The way will be clearer. To defeat the great silence. Then summon help. Without this, the pack will die. I was less sure I comprehended those lines. Defeat the silence. You mean the soundless god? The doorway that Reyna is supposed to open? Her response was frustratingly ambivalent. It could have meant yes and no, or sort of, or why are you so dense? I stared up at large golden dad. Zeus had thrown me into the middle of all this trouble. He'd stripped me of my power, then kicked me to the earth to free the oracles, defeat the emperors, and, oh wait, I got a bonus undead king and a silent god, too. I hoped the soot from the funeral pyre was really annoying Jupiter. I wanted to climb up his legs and finger right across his chest, wash me. I closed my eyes. This probably wasn't the wisest thing to do when facing a giant wolf, but I had too many half-formed ideas swirling around in my head. I thought about the Sibylline books, the various prescriptions they contained for warding off disasters. I considered what Lupa might mean by the great silence and summoning help. My eyes snapped open. Help. As in godly help. You mean if I survive the tomb and defeat the soundless whatever it is, I might be able to summon godly help? Lupa made a rumbling sound deep in her chest. Finally, he understands. This will be the beginning. The first step to rejoining your own pack. My heart thumped like it was falling down a flight of stairs. Lupa's message seemed too good to be true. I could contact my fellow Olympians, despite Zeus's standing orders that they shun me while I was human.
I might even be able to invoke their aid to save Camp Jupiter. Suddenly, I really did feel better. My gut didn't hurt. My nerves tingled with a sensation I hadn't felt for so long, I almost didn't recognize it. Hope.
Beware.
Lupa brought me back to reality with a low snarl.
The way is hard. You will face more sacrifices. Death. Blood.
No. I met her eyes, a dangerous sign of challenge that surprised me as much as it did her. No. I will succeed. I won't allow any more losses. There has to be a way. I managed maybe 3 seconds of eye contact before looking away. Lupa sniffed, a dismissive noise like, "Of course I won." But I thought I detected a hint of grudging approval, too. It dawned on me that Lupa appreciated my bluster and determination, even if she didn't believe I was capable of doing what I said. Maybe especially because she didn't believe it. "Rejoin the feast," she ordered. "Tell them you have my blessing. Continue to act strong. It is how we start." I studied the old prophecies set in the floor mosaic. I had lost friends to the triumvirate. I had suffered. But I realized that Lupa had suffered too. Her Roman children had been decimated. She carried the pain of all their deaths. Yet she had to act strong, even as her pack faced possible extinction. You couldn't lie in wolf, but you could bluff. Sometimes you had to bluff to keep a grieving pack together. What do mortals say? Fake it till you make it? That is a very wolfish philosophy. "Thank you." I looked up, but Lupa was gone. Nothing remained except silver mist, blending with the smoke from Jason's pyre. I gave Reyna and Frank the simplest version. I had received the wolf goddess's blessing. I promised to tell them more the next day, once I'd had time to make sense of it. Meanwhile, I trusted that word would spread among the Legion about Lupa giving me guidance. That would be enough for now. These demigods needed all the reassurance they could get. As the pyre burned, Frank and Hazel stood hand in hand, keeping vigil as Jason made his final voyage. I sat on a funeral picnic blanket with Meg, who ate everything in sight, and went on and on about her excellent afternoon tending unicorns with Lavinia. Meg boasted that Lavinia had even let her clean out the stables. "She pulled a Tom Sawyer on you," I observed. Meg frowned, her mouth filled with hamburger.
"What do you mean?"
"Nothing. You were saying about unicorn poop?" I tried to eat my dinner, but despite how hungry I was, the food tasted like dust. When the pyre's last embers died, and the wind spirits cleared away the remnants of the feast, we followed the legionnaires back to camp. Up in Bombilo's spare room, I lay on my cot and studied the cracks in the ceiling. I imagined they were lines of tattooed script across a cyclops's back. If I stared at them long enough, maybe they would start to make sense. Or at least I could find the index. Meg threw a shoe at me.
"You gotta rest. Tomorrow's the Senate meeting."
I brushed her red high top off my chest. "You're not asleep either."
"Yeah, but you'll have to speak. They'll want to hear your plan."
"My plan?"
"You know, like an oration. Inspire them and stuff. Convince them what to do. They'll vote on it and everything."
"One afternoon in the unicorn stables, and you're an expert on Roman senatorial proceedings?"
"Lavinia told me."
Meg sounded positively smug about it. She lay on her cot,
tossing her other high top in the air and catching it again. How she managed this without her glasses on, I had no idea. Minus the rhinestone cat-eye frames, her face looked older, her eyes darker and more serious. I would have even called her mature, had she not come back from her day at the stables wearing a glittery green t-shirt that read, "Unicornes in Parent." "What if I don't have a plan?" I asked. I expected Meg to throw her other shoe at me. Instead, she said, "You do."
"I do?"
"Yep. You might not have it all put together yet, but you will by tomorrow." I couldn't tell if she was giving me an order or expressing faith in me.
Or just vastly underestimating the dangers we faced.
"Continue to act strong," Lupa had told me. "It is how we start."
"Okay," I said tentatively. "Well, for starters, I was thinking that we could, not now, tomorrow. I don't want spoilers." Ah, there was the Meg I knew and tolerated. "What is it with you and spoilers?" I asked. "I hate them."
"I'm trying to strategize with you."
"Nope."
"Talking through my ideas."
"Nope."
She tossed aside her shoe, put a pillow over her head, and commanded in a muffled voice,
"Go to sleep."
Against a direct order, I had no chance. Weariness washed over me, and my eyelids crashed shut. Chapter 11. Dirt and Bubblegum. Lavinia brought enough for the whole Senate. How do you tell a dream from a nightmare? If it involves a book burning, it's probably a nightmare. I found myself in the Roman Senate room. Not the grand, famous chamber of the Republic or the Empire, but the old Senate room of the Roman Kingdom. The mud brick walls were painted slapdash white and red. Straw covered the filthy floor. Fires from iron braziers billowed soot and smoke, darkening the plaster ceiling. No fine marble here. No exotic silk or imperial purple grandeur. This was Rome in its oldest, rawest form. All hunger and viciousness. The royal guards wore cured leather armor over sweaty tunics. Their black iron spears were crudely hammered, their helmets stitched of wolf hide. Enslaved women knelt at the foot of the throne, which was a rough-hewn slab of rock covered with furs. Lining either side of the room were crude wooden benches. The bleachers for the senators, who sat more like prisoners or spectators than powerful politicians. In this era, senators had only one true power: to vote for a new king when the old one died. Otherwise, they were expected to applaud or shut up as required. On the throne sat Lucius Tarquinius Superbus, seventh king of Rome, murderer, schemer, slave driver, and all-around swell guy. His face was like wet porcelain cut with a steak knife. A wide, glistening mouth pulled into a lopsided scowl. Cheekbones too pronounced, a nose broken and healed in an ugly zigzag. Heavy-lidded, suspicious eyes, and long, stringy hair that looked like drizzled clay. Just a few years before, when he ascended the throne, Tarquin had been praised for his manly good looks and his physical strength. He dazzled the senators with flattery and gifts, then plopped himself onto his father-in-law's throne and persuaded the Senate to confirm him as the new king. When the old king rushed in to protest that he was, you know, still very much alive, Tarquin picked him up like a sack of turnips, carried him outside, and threw him into the street, where the old king's daughter, Tarquin's wife, ran over her unfortunate dad with her chariot, splattering the wheels with his blood.
A lovely start to a lovely reign. Now Tarquin wore his years heavily. He'd grown hunched and thick, as if all the building projects he'd forced on his people had actually been heaped on his own shoulders. He wore the hide of a wolf for a cloak. His robes were such a dark, mottled pink, it was impossible to tell if they'd once been red and then spattered with bleach, or had once been white and spattered with blood. Aside from the guards, the only person standing in the room was an old woman facing the throne. Her rose-colored hooded cloak, her hulking frame, and her stooped back made her look like a mocking reflection of the king himself, the Saturday Night Live version of Tarquin. In the crook of one arm, she held a stack of 6 leather-bound volumes, each the size of a folded shirt and just as floppy. The king scowled at her.
"You're back. Why?"
"To offer you the same deal as before."
The woman's voice was husky, as if she'd been shouting. When she pulled down her hood, her stringy gray hair and haggard face made her look even more like Tarquin's twin sister. But she was not. She was the Cumaean Sybil. Seeing her again, my heart twisted. She had once been a lovely young woman, bright, strong-willed, passionate about her prophetic work. She had wanted to change the world. Then things between us soured, and I had changed her instead. Her appearance was only the beginning of the curse I had set on her. It would get much, much worse as the centuries progressed.